light someplace, and I'm afraid I'll turn the wrong thing off. We'll get to those in a minute. Okay, what do you think? We should
hear
it?
Okay. Launch.
Okay. So, welcome. This is strange, doing this in front of it, not having this in my hand. Because we're on a little bit of a time constraint tonight, I think we're going to not do the hand around the microphone part as we usually do. But we will kind of ask some questions about what people are doing and get a show of hands on a couple of things. So, welcome. This is the point where I do the brief AES commercial. It says right here in my notes. Some of you, actually, why don't I just start right off by asking how many here are members of the AES, either student or regular. So we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. AES member?
No.
Ah, okay, 10. So 10 is our member. Are you going to write that down?
10. It's on the recording.
It's on the recording. You're smart. Okay, so tonight's presentation is going to be on theater sound design. I'll introduce our speaker here in a few minutes. But for those of you that aren't members of the AES, I just want to give you a little bit of a pitch that membership is a good thing. You get a lot of access to information. In fact, now as AES members, you get access to the whole AES papers library as well as everything else directly online. You can go to aes.org to look into membership, and if they ask you on the membership application for a reference, you can talk to any one of the committee members or drop a note to us on the Facebook page or one of the others, and we can serve as that recommendation to you. That formality is something that I think eventually will drop away, but right now it's still there. Just to get an idea here, how many people in the room are or have at some point in their career worked in theater sound? Well, that's a pretty good number. Some have worked more than once, I see.
How many will admit it?
Yeah. Yes. Who's primarily doing studio? It's here? Okay. Who is just primarily doing engineering or other kinds of things? Okay, there's a lot of other categories, and a lot of people are putting up their hands twice, which is good, because this is an industry that we cross over a lot. So I want to thank Shoreline Community College for hosting us again at this location. I'd let you know the next meeting is May 30th. And that will be at the UW campus, and we'll be treated to a presentation around the fascinating Harry Partch instrument collection, which is pretty good. I'm not going to say too much about it now, but Google that Harry Partch instrument collection if you don't know anything about that, and you will begin to want to be at our May 30th event. And we're hoping that we might be able to hear some of the instruments. We don't know exactly how far that's going to go.
Apparently, there was an article in the Seattle Times, uh-huh. And there are links to sounds.
Okay, terrific. So for tonight, we need to try to be out of here. We need to be out of here, clear the building by 10 o'clock. And that's so that the good people that work here at Shoreline can get home on time and not get stuck here until the wee hours of the morning while we slog out of here. So we're going to try to stick fairly close to our schedule. The timing that Brendan will be doing an initial presentation. We'll stop that right around 8:30 or thereabouts. We'll take about a 10-minute short break. We have cookies and water. And after the break, we'll do a quick door prize presentation and then take the time to do question and answers, demos, continuing on if we have things that we need to continue on with, try to cut at about between 9:30 and 9:40 so we have time to clear out of here and leave everybody smiling as we go. So if it seems like we're a little more than usual kind of pushing people to get back from break, that's why we're going to try to start right off the bat as quickly as we can at a 10-minute break. Anything else announcement-wise that I need to do before? Can't think of anything? Okay, good. So I'd like to introduce our presenter tonight, Brendan Patrick Hogan. Brendan is a sound designer and composer and all-around geek, I guess would be a good way to put it, working in the Seattle area. I met Brendan when he was very highly recommended to me by colleagues at Cornish College of the Arts when I was teaching there and needed someone to take over the sound design program there that I was teaching at the time. And happily, Brendan came along, and I was able to hand that over to him, and he turned out to be an exceptional instructor and a very good rapport with the students, and I felt perfectly comfortable turning my hands loose from that entire program at the time. Brendan's work combines practices in composition, sound, and media design for theater, dance, and film, as well as electronics programming and show control systems for live and installation immersive performance. He's done over 50 productions at ACT Theater, where you spent, what, six seasons as the resident sound designer. Did the original design and original music for Red at Seattle Repertory Theater in 2012. Got quite a few other projects in various different theaters in town, from Seattle Shakespeare to Strawberry Theater Workshop to Washington Ensemble Theater. He's a two-time winner of Best Musical Score at the Seattle 48-Hour Film Project, professional memberships in IATSE, IATSE, Stage Employees, United Scenic Artists, USA Local 829, American Federation of Music, Musicians Association of Seattle. And in addition to theatrical work, you perform with Miss Mamie Livona and The Bad Things, right?
Yep.
So without further ado, I'm going to hand it over to Brendan, and I'll go around and turn some lights off here. So.
Great. Thanks very much for having me, everyone. My great honor to be here and to present on theater sound design. So as Dave mentioned, I met Dave about 3 or 4 years ago when some colleagues who teach at Cornish College of the Arts, Roberta Russell and Melanie Burgess, approached me and asked if I would be interested in taking over the sound design program. And my background, just to kind of flesh that out a little bit more, is I came to sound design, to theater design in general, as a musician first. That's where I first got into working in audio, working with audio, and as a performer who then became very, very interested in the technology, trying to make our rigs sound better when we went out to do a gig, that kind of thing. I was equally interested in being on stage and being behind a desk or working backstage. So what I, over many, many years, I'm really very, very lucky, and you're gonna hear me say that a lot, that I'm very lucky to be doing what I'm doing, because my path to this point has been very serendipitous. So when you hear me say, like, oh, I was very lucky to have this opportunity to meet this person, I really do believe that. My training and my schooling, when I went to college at the University of California, Santa Cruz, I studied music. I worked in the electronic music program, which was very young at the time. And then I also studied history, which is actually what my degree is in. So I have a very kind of circuitous route to getting to being a working sound designer. You could almost say that my wife is a performer, and we actually met in college, so I sort of married into the business a little bit. From my music background and from playing music and being interested in the technology and expressing kind of an interest in active listening, which another thing you're going to hear me kind of harp on a lot tonight, I came into first theatrical sound design and then sound design for film. And now what I spend a lot of my time doing is programming control and media systems for installations, as you heard Dave mention. So reactive audio systems, things that use motion tracking or temperature and pressure sensing, things that take into account those aspects of a performance that we often feel we can't control. So when we're doing design for theater, one of the things that we really strive for is reliability and reproducibility. Generally speaking, we want the cues to fire at the same place, the same time, with some variance for maybe an actor makes a cross quicker in one moment or slower on a night by night. The stage manager adjusts as necessary, but for the most part, we sort of want it to run almost as if it were a movie, where there's a start, there's a middle, there's an end, and the cues kind of run in the way that they do. But one thing that I'm really interested in, and I've been able to bring it into my theater design practice a little bit, is to think about those things that we normally can't control for, like the audience, who, you know, I mean, it's the part of a production that we often feel is, I think, not paid attention to enough from a design side, which might seem weird to say because it's like, well, you just designed this thing that was on stage for an audience. But it's almost as if it's very easy to kind of fall into a pattern of producing work as a designer that lives on the stage and lives in between the moment that the curtain goes up and the curtain goes down, and we think of the audience as being passive. They're the other part of the production that's just sort of there. And what I try and do is really think about the fact that the audience is an integral part of any production we do. You know, art making, particularly in theater, doesn't exist in the vacuum. We do this for an audience. We do this because we think that the story we're telling is valuable, and we think other people will want to hear it and want to see it and want to experience it. So thinking about those parts of a performance that we normally think we have no control over, where people sit, how loud they are, if they're opening up candy, even though there was probably an announcement telling them not to do that, all those sort of things that normally are just kind of background noise and an annoyance, flipping that on its head a little bit and putting it in the context of an experience that the audience is free to move around in, then we suddenly have a whole range of opportunities for performance and performance control and things that can react to your audience. We're going to get to that a little bit later. I've kind of broken this down a little bit into three parts for the initial presentation. Traditional theatrical sound design, so mostly playback, sound effects, music playback, in the context of dramatic presentation. A little bit about live design, mostly in the context of musical theater. That's where we primarily deal with live reinforcement systems. And then the third part will be about this idea of sort of reactive or immersive design, or design that embraces chance or indeterminacy, to put it in the context of John Cage, which I'll be coming back to a little bit. So first, when we talk about theater design, it's important to think about what is this kind of vague term design when we say that? Well, in a theater context, design is about making choices. It's about making choices about a created experience that a bunch of people are coming together to present. So me as a sound designer, responsible for the aural realm, and now increasingly more the video or projections realm as well, collaborating with the lighting designer, with the scenic designer, with the costume designer, with the director, and with the company of actors, and the board operators, the stage manager, the automation engineer who's running the lifts. Everyone has come together to tell a story, to create a reality for some amount of time that we're presenting to an audience. This is kind of the first approach, the first doorway into thinking about designing for theater. Is inherently, it's about storytelling. So just very much in the same way that an interior designer makes choices about presentation, very much in the same way that a scenic designer would, they're creating an aesthetic experience for a user or for a client, for an audience member. The idea is kind of the same. So what I'll be kind of going over tonight are these three basic categories: dramatic, playback, sound effects, live design and reinforcement, and then generative improvisational sort of works. We get outside of a traditional theater context and get talk a little bit about what has actually been becoming a lot more sort of popular and prominent in pop-up theaters or in black box theaters, is the idea of immersion, not just surround sound and surround lighting, but including the audience as an actual reactive part of the production, whatsoever that production might be. So I'll have some examples on that. So one of the things that has always really, fascinated me about sound and how we listen and how we experience events on stage has a lot to do with how our brains sort of process memory and experience, how our brains seek pattern and order. We try and relate an event or an experience to something that we've experienced in the past, and we form memory and we form experience that we can draw on. And with sound, what's always been so, I find really, really engaging is that, at least in a theatrical context, sound is the design element that you can't see, and generally speaking, you can't touch. Sound is temporal, inherently. Whereas we can look at a stage, we can look at a production in process, a play in process, and you can shut your eyes and you can freeze that instant in your memory, regardless of the passage of time. It's like looking at a painting. It exists outside of time at that point. But with sound, because we're dealing with the propagation of pressure waves through a medium, we can only experience that through the passage of time. So playing with the sensation of time moving or setting an audience within space and time is something that we can do with sound that almost exists outside of the conscious mind. So when we're designing something, certainly with a surround sound system, playing with sourcing where sounds come from, the level they're playing with, a lot of what I'm doing is manipulating experience and manipulating memory, sort of at a subconscious level. As Dave mentioned, I worked at ACT Theater for 6 seasons, working in all of their spaces. Just show of hands, has anyone been to ACT Theater to see a show there? So ACT has two main stage performance spaces. One is a 3/4 thrust and the other is an arena, a 360 space. It's constructed in the former Eagles Area Number 1 at the corner of 7th and Union, right by the Convention Center in Seattle. And the arena space is far and away my favorite space to design in the city, because you can play with height and distance in a way that's very difficult in any other sort of location, because I literally have that physical height and space to play with. The arena is built in what was the former Grand Ballroom. So it goes, it's about a 4-story open room with a walking grid, all of the lighting pipe grid, sort of an acoustical baffling cloud that moves around it. And then there's about 10 rows of seats, 360 degrees. It seats about 440 people. So it's actually fairly intimate, 440 people and only 10 rows. And one of the things I really love about working there is that we're able to move designed sound from stage level all the way up to the very ceiling of the space. And we really get that sense of height and motion in a way that's difficult to do with picking up a scenic object and moving it somewhere else, where there's, with sound design, I can disconnect from the physical and just play with the experience and with the emotional attachment, that the emotional connection that the audience has to what they're hearing but not seeing, which is a fun thing to play with. So I keep talking about this thing, storytelling. And in theater, theater is all about storytelling. Like I talked about a little bit earlier, as a group of designers, as a group of collaborators and constructors and makers, to use that term that kind of gets used a little bit too much, we've all come together and decided that we are going to create an experience for an audience that we think is worth telling and is worth telling again. Hence, we want to sell as many tickets as we can. It keeps the theater open. But the point is that this impulse for storytelling is ancient and it's very, very human. So, for instance, the Lascaux Caves in France, the very famous Paleolithic caves with the charcoal drawings of the hunt and of the bison, and it's the very famous cave painting location that a lot of people have, might have seen in a video or what have you. The evidence, the locations within the cave that have the evidence of the greatest human activity, where the fires were, where there are chips and stone, where there might have been a primitive lithophone banging a rock on another one to make sound, to enhance a dramatic event. It probably won't surprise you that those areas within the caves are the most reverberant parts of the cave, that our ancient humans, even though they couldn't explain it necessarily, they knew that there was something special about these locations, that if I stand here and reenact the hunt and I clap my hands, there's this great echoing, there's this reverberance, there's this life that exists there that doesn't if I just step a few places over here, a few steps over here. So that impulse to drama, that impulse to storytelling is really, really ancient, and we carry this with us today as theater practitioners. So I have two quotes here from two books that I really like and I come back to a lot. And it's about listening and hearing and how when we think as a theatrical sound designer, a lot of what we're thinking about is not so much what people see, but what we hear consciously, what we hear unconsciously. And this, all of these slides I'll make available afterwards. There's a bunch of links and references at the end. So by all means, take photos if you want to, but I'll make sure that everyone can get this if they want. That's great, yeah, perfect. So the first comes from a great book by Dina Kay and James Lebrecht called Sound and Music for the Theater. And it's from the theater director, Peter Sellers. And he says, we can shut our eyes, but we can still hear. We can shut our ears, but sound is still echoing inside our skulls. We exist in a universe of sound. In the beginning was the word, and before the word was written, it was spoken, and its sound keeps speaking in our minds and our hearts, and we can't stop listening. And the next from Salome Vogelin, who has a great book, relatively recently published, called Listening to Noise and Silence, and it's about sound art and how to conceptualize sound art, what sound art means as a practice. Says a similar thing. Sounds constantly enter my ears, bounding around in there, declaring their interest even if I am not listening. As I walk through a busy urban street, I try to ignore the incessant hum of thick traffic, the noisy commotion and vocal drone of people around me. However, the fact that I do not listen to them consciously or willingly does not mean that these sounds do not shape the reality as it presents itself to me. These are two great examples of the fact that we can shut our eyes, but we can never really shut our ears. I mean, you know, we can muffle ourselves really, really well, but the point being that, you know, anyone who's worked, who's done any sort of recording will know this, that the mic hears everything, right? That our brains can switch off those parts of our oral landscape that are not of immediate interest. This is how we can have a conversation in a crowded restaurant and still understand ourselves. So we've all experienced this. But it's when you put the mic out and you hear everything that you didn't hear. This is a exercise when I was at Cornish College I would have my students do. Is I'd say, pick a journey that you're familiar with. It could be your bus ride from your apartment to the theater. It could be the walk from the cafeteria to the dormitory. Something you know really well. Something you do daily or weekly or what have you. Something that is familiar. And, you know, most people have a smartphone or something to record with, so turn that thing on before you leave. And I want you to really, really, really consciously listen and document everything that you hear as you make that journey. Really, really listen. You know, not just a car pass, but how big did the engine sound? Did you hear planes come over you? How did your perception of that car passing you change? Did you hear the pitch shift? Were you conscious of that? If there was a car passing you in the other direction, could you actually track that in real time in your conscious mind? Get to where you're going, turn the recorder off, leave it for a little while, maybe the next day, get your notepad out of all the things you heard, and then listen back to the recording and see how many things you didn't hear. See how many things are happening around us at all times that our brains do not allow us to be consciously aware of, because if we could actively listen to everything that was happening all the time, we'd probably go a little bit crazy. That's just too much information to deal with. But that's something that as a as a sound designer, someone who is constructing that sonic reality within the theater, it gives me a huge palette to play with. Not just if it's, oh, this is an outdoor scene and here's, or it's a street scene or what have you, but here's a very literal street scene and then some other tones that I'm going to put in there that are just at the threshold of hearing that just add color and maybe add an unconscious feel, or that I can basically create a sense of ease or dis-ease with subliminal tones, be they, you know, infrasonic or, you know, somewhere sort of high frequency. I can play with people's realities because they are, or they should be, actively engaged in the play that's happening. If they're not, we're really doing something wrong. You know, if they're really, really paying attention to the sound design, then the play is not probably that great. So I try not to be in the forefront of everyone's mind. Usually what I'm doing is playing a little bit in the background until we get to things like transitions or scene to scene or specific things that get called out in the script. So with sound design, when we do it in the theatrical context, our first avenue into the piece is usually the script, unless you're working with a piece that's generative, that's being written as you're going along. That can be very, very fun and also really challenging to kind of figure out what it is that our end result is going to be. So about 7 years ago, I had an opportunity to design a play called Yankee Tavern that was written by Stephen Dietz, and he directed the play as well. And we had a meeting, early design meeting, well before rehearsal started. I think it might have even been before the first group meeting of the designers. Stephen has a very, very strong musical sensibility. He's very, very attuned to telling stories with music and sound. So it was important to him that it was the first time we'd worked together. It was important for him that we establish a rapport early on. And he said when we first started to talk about the play, one of the smartest things I think anyone's ever said, or smartest question anyone's asked when talking about a play or a piece of art or a film or what have you, which is, don't tell me what happened. Tell me what it's about. I should reinforce that he wrote this play as well. He's like, I know what happens. I wrote it. What is it about? What are the themes that are part of this storytelling? How do we want to present this story? This particular play was one that took place more or less contemporary in Lower Manhattan in a sort of funky rundown tavern, ground level, someplace not that far from Battery, you know, north of Financial. You could walk to Battery Park, just kind of locate yourself a little bit. And it was a story this is to be a weird thing to just sort of throw out there, but it had a little bit to do with 9/11 conspiracy theory, but it was mostly about trust between people. Can you ever really know if the person you know is actually that person? So there was a character who was very, very convinced that the tower collapse was an inside job, and he was kind of the tavern regular, and then the protagonist was the younger guy who ran it, who took it over from his father. I'm not going to bore you with all the detail, but the point is that to construct the sonic world of this, we were in the arena again, we decided that, hey, we're in Manhattan. Manhattan's never quiet. Like, you always hear the city at some point. So I was able to construct a continuous sound bed that ran over almost the entirety of the play. And you heard it from what would have been the door, sort of scenically to the exterior, the door open and closed. Obviously, you get the realism of you hear more traffic and whatnot. There was this constant tone that started nice and strong, and as we went scene by scene, I just ducked it down a few dB at a time to the point that it was still there if you looked for it or listened for it, but not so if it was unconscious. And the payoff I got from this, because I had set up this expectation in the audience's mind that this sound is always going to be here. There was one moment where we came out of narrative underscoring, and instead of the street sounds resuming as they had in the previous four instances of music underscoring back to reality, it went to silence. And it was one of the most satisfying moments that I've ever had as a designer, because everyone in the audience sort of went, just sort of did, there was this real odd sensation of watching people in preview performances of just registering that something very different has happened, but we don't know what it is. And then I kind of crept the sound back up and people sort of eased back into their chairs. I can't explain that behavior kind of psychologically. It was fascinating to watch, but it was a huge payoff because then I was using silence as a design tool instead of sound. So that's, we mentioned John Cage earlier. We're going to come back to John Cage. I'm a huge fan and devotee of his work, and he was also a master of using silence. That sometimes, to use a very big cliche from jazz music, sometimes it's not the notes you play, it's the notes you don't. That's very true within design, because again, we're making choices about when to present sound and oftentimes when not to as well. And there, you can get those moments of great payoff, which are really, really satisfying. So as we approach the play, we basically establish some rules for storytelling. Anyone who's worked in theater has probably heard this spiel before from a director. We need to set the rules of our play. How do we do transitions? Do we dump out lights very quickly and go into music or whatever transitions to us? Do we gradually fade in between? What is the sort of functional way that we progress from curtain up to curtain down? And a lot of that has to do with, you know, are sounds loud? Are they soft? Are they somewhere in between? Are they very realistic? Are they very abstract? We kind of set this up at the beginning. So we make choices about how we're going to present it, often by reinforcing or playing against expectations, like the street sounds that I then took away to silence. I had set up in the mind of the audience the expectation, subconsciously, that this city was here all the time. And then when I take that away, when I break that expectation, I can get a lot of dramatic payoff from that, which is super, super fun. So with sound design, because again, it's the thing that we can't look at. Generally speaking, we can't touch. Audiences are not often sitting on the cabinets. We have a lot of, we have a great sort of duty and also a lot of latitude with establishing time and place. And we usually do this right around the point that the curtain comes up. If it's a theater without a grand drape and you see the set as soon as you walk in to take your seat when the house opens, that then allows the audience to set up some expectations on their own of a certain type of presentation that they might expect. So if we come into an Edwardian drawing room, we have a decent idea of what type of play we are likely to see. Or if we come into an absolutely bare stage, flat white stage, you know, maybe we're going to do a Bauhaus sort of thing. We don't know what to expect. That can also be very exciting for the audience. And maybe we have pre-show music, maybe we don't. That's an opportunity to set up some certain sonic rules or to welcome people into this constructed reality that we're presenting to them. But often what I've found in my practice, a great way to set time and place, particularly if it's a play that it's important for the audience to understand specifically when it takes place, and we can't always rely on people to read the program note that says our play takes place September to December in 1992, then what I've found is really, really helpful is to use, to set up my top of show sequence as a way of establishing not only maybe musical tone, but also telling people where we are chronologically. And one technique that I've used a few times is to pepper in snippets from news broadcasts from that period, which might seem like kind of like, well, yeah, that's sure, you would do that. But I've actually found it to be very, very effective, particularly if you can get anything to do with world events. I'm going to play an example in a second. So there was a piece I did by John Robin Bates, who he was the writer for the TV show Brothers and Sisters. He wrote a great play called Other Desert Cities. And it is about it's a family drama where you learn that there's a daughter who's a successful writer. Both of the parents were former actors, very much in the vein of Ronald Reagan. There's the implication that they hung out with Ron and Nancy, that they were part of that California, sort of classic California conservative Hollywood scene, and that there's a son who may have committed some sort of really terrible crime that no one talks about, and it's revealed later. It's a, if you ever get a chance to see it, it is a really terrific play. It's a great story, so I don't want to give too much away. But the point is that when the curtain goes up, we are just after the Iraq invasion. We are at Christmas time after that has happened. So the audience walks in, they see a very lavish, sort of Palm Springs style den family room and a Christmas tree. So that's kind of the only thing to tell you time of year. And what the director and I settled on was that there are only a couple scene transitions. It's a four scene play in about 2 hours, so it's a lot of talking. That we were going to really hit with the Christmas idea, but we were going to do jazz arrangements of Christmas songs because the patriarch makes reference to sort of the Chet Baker, Jerry Mulligan era of West Coast jazz as being something that he was very fond of in the past. So in order to tell people that this is where we are, we made this. I'm going to go away from this for a second. Pardon me. So at this part, the audience knows nothing about... I'm sorry. I did my mix poorly. Let me duck that down some more so you can hear the... The voice is better.
This is important today for us all as we review the situation with respect to Iraq and its disarmament obligation.
Major combat operations in Iraq have ended.
Inspectors are inspectors.
The United States.
They are not detectives.
And our allies have prevailed.
Voters turned out in record numbers and delivered an historic victory. Earlier today, Senator Kerry called with his congratulations. We had a really good phone call. He was very gracious.
And that was the audience's entry into that play. So establishing the year with familiar voices, with familiar themes, as a way of kind of getting people up to speed so that when the lights came up, we are in that world and a little bit in that that sort of reality. And along with that, in terms of setting mood, establishing place and time, setting mood and tone, obviously this one gets into our play in a very bouncy sort of way, and then we hear clips about war, so we're slightly mixed signal as we bring the audience into this moment. We're leaving them in a place where they're not quite sure what to expect. Then the writing in the first scene is very comedic and it sets people at ease, and then the story of the, you know, the son and what may or may not have occurred kind of takes it from there. So I don't want to take up too much time. I have other examples we can play afterwards, but I want to make sure that we get to some other topics. So another great book that I'm sure many of you have read, or if not are at least familiar with, is Murray Schafer's book, The Soundscape, which was basically acoustic ecology, 1977, I believe. It is a really, really great piece on, to put it in a single phrase, active listening. Actively listening to the sonic world around us and noting what has prominence, what has what is more subliminal, what is it about our daily lives that is of sonic importance or does not have sort of sonic importance. And he outlines four sort of categories of what the sort of the sound landscape, the soundscape, is all about. And the first one is keynote sounds. Sounds that anchor a location and give it meaning but are not always consciously heard. Running water, wind, birds, insects, things like that. Background sounds. Signal sounds, Sounds that are in the foreground and are listened to consciously or can't be ignored. Sirens, bells, shouting, things like that. He gives the great parallel to the visual arts where he says, if keynote is ground, then signal is figure. The keynote gives relief to the signal sounds. So they function at two depths, as it were. Then we have sound marks, very much like a landmark, sounds which are unique or possess qualities that make them specially noticed or regarded by members of a community. So I used to live in Ballard for many, many years, and the sound of the bell saying that the bridge is going to go up is something that became very, very familiar with me because I live very close to the bridge. So it's something that I would recognize, I would probably recognize out of context, or at least if I heard something similar, it would create, it would pull the memory in my mind of the bridge. It would put me in that location. Now I live very much further south in the city, and I'm closer to the Burlington Northern train yard down in SoTo, and on a foggy day, I can hear the train horns very clearly, even though I'm miles away. So that's another thing that grounds me to that location that has meaning for me. In the same way that the chimes of Big Ben would be an establishing sound for London, in the same way that if you're watching a film and you do a copter shot of the Thames and Palace of Westminster, it says, we are in London now. Similar idea. And finally, archetypal sounds, which are associated with a specific time or place in the past. So something like a sword fight or wagon wheels on cobblestones, something that puts you in a specific time, or a specific engine sound, or a steam train or something like that, something that carries with it a knowledge, either direct or indirect, of a particular time and place. These are the four types of sounds, generally speaking, that when we're creating a soundscape for theater, we're thinking about. What is in the background? What are people just experiencing sort of passively? What are they meant to hear? How do we place them within time and space? And then what are the sounds that really ground you within that reality? And the reason that we kind of do all that analysis, or that I do all that analysis, is thinking about the fact that sound carries meaning for the listener. That there are sound and smell, to a great degree as well, is really, really good at drawing up memories, even if you can't consciously place them at the time. Familiarity with things that we don't have a visual reference for is a very, very powerful part of our brains. And with design, we can either set up those expectations and reinforce them, or we can smash them. And sometimes we do both many, many times throughout the course of a particular production. So the other big part of at least dramatic theater, we've been talking mostly about sound effects, is music for theater, which generally speaking takes two general forms. It's sourced, it's something that's pulled from library stock or maybe iTunes, or it's something that's composed specifically for that. And then it falls a little bit into three kind of general categories. There's incidental, what's sort of legally referred to as incidental music, and transition music, getting us into a show, scene to scene, things that happen that are not necessarily synchronous with the action of the play. Many directors do like to kind of choreograph the mechanics of a scene transition to music, but it's not meant, the presentation is not such as if the characters are hearing that music. This is something that exists a little bit out of time. So for us to think about as designers then, because again, we're making choices about a constructed reality, what does the audience hear that moves the action between scenes or moves to another time and place? How does it relate to the story? What is the audience supposed to understand from this particular track that either I've written or I've sourced from a library or what have you? What is the meaning of this track? Then underscoring, things that happen within the context of the scene, that is sort of a cinematic technique. Again, not one that the characters are necessarily are aware of. It's not meant to be literally in reality. It just adds drama. And then finally, what's called for in the script, the music or the sounds that are called out in the script and are integral to the action. Some playwrights are can be helpful or unhelpful in how specific they are. Some playwrights are really, really specific in what goes into a script. Arthur Miller is a great example of a playwright who is very, very specific about a very small number of sound cues. They turn on the phonograph and hear this track, and that might be the only sonic direction you get in the entire play. The Arthur Miller piece, The Price, is a really good example of this, where there's basically one part, there's two sound cues explicitly in a, like a 2.5 hour play, and it's a phonograph and a specific Joe and Paul vaudeville comedy hour track that's heard. And outside of that, the designer has free rein to do what they want, but it's important to keep in mind that because Miller is so specific about those two choices, we don't necessarily want to add anything that's unnecessary. So you, I always really try and be conscious of not stepping on the words. That's something that you'll hear designers talk about a lot, is we can, don't get in the way of the acting. The acting is the direct storytelling, the direct access that the audience has to the presentation is usually the spoken word or some sort of action. Maybe it's dance, but people are, the audience is watching the people. Try not to put the scenery in the way of the people. Try not to put the sound so upfront in the audience's consciousness that they can't pay attention to the words. Again, if someone is really, really preoccupied or can only listen to the sound design or like can only look at the lighting design, it usually means we're doing something wrong. You'll hear a lot of sound designers in particular, but a lot of designers generally say that if you don't get mentioned in a review, sometimes that's good. Because oftentimes if you get mentioned in a review, it's because something really weird happened. Like, I couldn't stand that racket. Or like, I couldn't see the people half the time. They were in the dark or something like that. That usually if, sometimes if you don't get a reference, it means it just worked. It was completely absorbed and consumed inobtrusively. It did its job. And these three elements are the sort of thing that as a designer, we have to think about all of these sort of things, not just as sound design, but in the very, to put it in the sense of lighting design, what do we see when we move scene by scene? Underscoring, what does the scene itself look like? How do you shift lighting levels to play with emotion, to isolate people to a particular area when they move there, or when they're telling a particularly dramatic part of the script? How do we pull in on them, and if so, how? And then in the script would be practical things. They come in and flip on a light. Great. Do they really touch a light switch? Are we playing that game? Is there a lamp that they really can pull on? Things like that. And that kind of brings us a good segue into sound design for live design and reinforcement, which is going to be mostly in the context of musical theater. Does anyone consider themselves a musical theater aficionado or go to musical theater? Is this a little bit? I'm not going to judge you either way. I will freely admit that I used to really not be a fan of musical theater until I started working in it, and I sort of got it. I got the mechanics of why people burst into song in a way that looks really silly. It's what is it about this moment emotionally that can only be expressed in song? And it's like, oh, okay. When I got my brain there and I accepted it, I'm like, I like working on these shows. I love building reinforcement systems. When I was much, much, much younger, I did act in a couple musicals. And by much, much, much younger, I mean like once or twice, and went, you should maybe not do this. I much prefer to be on the other side of the stage. I perform as a musician all the time, and it's even after all these years, I'm like, oh God, there are people here who are going to watch me do this. Yeah, it's tough for me to get over that. So I like working in the background. I like being a designer. I like building things and then stepping back and letting people do whatever they will with it. So for live design, very much like with dramatic design, we're thinking about imaging, localizing sound, sourcing. Where does the audience hear the sounds coming from? In a dramatic sense, we would think about is a field ambience coming from a surround system? Is it coming from speakers that are at deck level? Where is the audience meant to understand that this is occurring? And likewise with reinforcement design or musical theater design, What we always really want to avoid, and anyone who's ever seen a musical or worked on any musicals, is the deadly upstairs-downstairs effect, where your reinforcement system is so physically separated from your actors that the McGurk effect is not our friend in this point. So the McGurk effect is the situation in which when there's a disagreement between what you see and what you hear, what you see will always win. Your visual cortex will always defeat your auditory cortex. There's a terrific clip on YouTube from the BBC that demonstrates the McGurk effect. Just, it's worth watching because you cannot untrick your brain from it. It's really fascinating. But in a theatrical context, in a performance context, if we're sitting in an audience and we see the people there, but we hear their voices coming from above their head, we probably don't have enough speakers. The separation between the direct sound, the natural voice, and the reinforced voice is extreme, and it's distracting because there's a disagreement between what we see and what we hear, and it's distracting for the audience. So theatrical sound design from a live standpoint, I think the last system I built was for Murder for Two. Again, at ACT, it seems like it's the only place I work. I swear I work other places, which is very funny and running now. You should see it. I think we had 53 boxes, I think, for a 400-seat three-quarter thrust. Because actually it had the system was just as robust for sound effects as it was for voice and instrument reinforcement because it's a vaudeville comedy. And we needed all of those different locations for sounds to come from. But in a three-quarter thrust, it's a good example to talk about because it's kind of hard to do reinforcement in a three-quarter thrust where it isn't a sort of monolithic presentation like a proscenium where everyone's generally getting the reinforcement in one direction. Three-quarter thrust, you have an orchestra section. So if I'm standing on stage, I have you guys in front of me, I have people there, I have people there, I have people in the gallery, all of whom need to hear the show that they paid for. There's a phrase that I try and come back to remind myself, and also when I was teaching, I would remind the students, is that everyone bought a ticket, everyone sees the show. There shouldn't be any bad seats. It shouldn't be that just because you're up in the gallery, oh, you don't get as much of the reinforcement signal. It's going to sound a little thin up there because you bought the cheap seats. No, they came to see your show too. You have to take them into consideration. So usually what that means is a lot of boxes. And aligning those boxes, working out the delay compensation for time alignment. So for those of us who are maybe in school or just recently graduated, how much of this is sort of familiar concept? If you talk about time aligning speakers or aligning delays off a main system that we're kind of in a... Okay, cool, great. So in a three-quarter thrust, that is very hard. In a proscenium, less so. You may have more delay systems because your house may be deeper, but what we don't have is, you know, have to think about having two zero times. Do you have a vocal zero? Do you have a band zero? How do we sort of deal with this? And we put as much time into it as we do because, again, even though it's musical theater, I don't mean to be that dismissive, it's still storytelling. We are still collectively deciding that what we're about to put on stage is worth watching and people should come see it. With live design, very much less so than dramatic theater is miking and certainly RF systems, which is becoming increasingly difficult as the FCC does what it does. Though, thankfully, the 600 megahertz auction is not nearly as catastrophic as it could have been. We still are losing a lot of spectrum. We still have to cram as many channels and more, as smaller theaters start to do musicals, into an ever-diminishing spectrum. So, your A2, your RF engineer on a musical, has a much harder job now than we did 5-10 years ago. You know, when we lost the 700 megahertz band, it was a big bummer. People moved down. A lot of people moved down into the 600 megahertz because they were suddenly cheap. And now that's going away, and people who went down to the high 400s are really, really happy because they've got some breathing room. They probably bought digital transmitters as well, so they're hopefully doing okay. And the 600 megahertz move made total sense at the time, but now, unfortunately, we're losing that spectrum as well, or a good portion of it, so it's going to be challenging for places like, to give a local example, Fifth Avenue Theater, who routinely run 45, 46, 47 plus channels per show. They have what's called a Part 74 license that allows them to actually apportion specific bandwidth for use. They can get a license that's, in a general sense, it kind of puts them in a similar position as a radio station where you're saying, hey, I'm paying to use this spectrum, this portion of the wireless spectrum. Whereas if you go down to Guitar Center and you buy a wireless microphone, you use it and you're free to use it. It may not work everywhere you go. If you are close to a higher power transmitter, that will win. And your mic may not work, and you may need to dodge around. And you have no recourse when that happens. If you pay a handsome sum, you can get a license that basically allows you to say, I routinely use X number of channels or more as part of my business, i.e., we're in the business of musical theater. And it gives the Fifth Avenue a little bit of leeway, but they still get hit all the time. So their wireless engineer, Jim Rudy, works a lot. They've got a really nice Sennheiser system, and he worries about it constantly. Even though it works great, he still worries about it. And the big thing here, that's why I put control in big capital letters here, is that, like we talked about in the beginning with dramatic design, with live design as well, we want things to be reliable and repeatable. So, you know, I want to know that when, say, SoundCue 50, which is a gunshot or whatnot, and is called on an actor's motion, that the stage manager is going to call it on that motion every time, or, you know, within reason every time, that there isn't a big lag. And if that lag is a result not of the call happening late, but there being a system lag, there's some sort of, there's a transmission lag within the system, or, uh-oh, that button seems to be broken. These are all the sort of things that in theater, even though it's live performance, we almost want to take the live aspect out of it and have the liveness, put the liveness on the performers and say, you guys are the live part. We're going to try and make this run kind of mechanically so that you can do your show and not have to wait for, like, that light cue should have gone by now. I guess I'll just improvise my way off stage and all of that awkwardness, because that happens. What we want is that level of control. So that then brings me into, I see the clock there, I'll talk really briefly, and then we can play with some stuff later, on what if we want to give up that control. So if we normally want reliability and reproducibility, what about things like the audience? What about things like non-traditional seating? What if there's mobile seating? KT Niehoff did a really terrific dance piece at 12th Avenue Arts that closed a couple weeks ago that had audience members in chairs kind of like this on swiveling platforms that were about an inch off the deck. And they were just spread out kind of throughout the floor. So it was a dance piece that happened all around the audience. It wasn't a traditional bank seating like this. And it opened up the space in this incredible way because the audience were free to not only look over their shoulder, but to actually move and follow people in space on this little bearing caster. And what it did, I thought, was a really, really good example of the fact that particularly dance, which is such a dynamic presentation medium, allows the entire space to be used in a way that traditional end stage seating sets up certain expectations and limitations of what that type of presentation can be. So, can these things be then useful tools for us? So a great example of this is the work of John Cage and Merce Cunningham and their collaboration. So they were sort of famous slash notorious slash however you want to think about it for doing these original compositions for dance where they wouldn't actually rehearse with each other. That Cage would write the music without having seen the choreography, and Cunningham would choreograph the piece without hearing the music, and the dancers and the musicians would come together for the first performance, and they would perform the piece, the other never having seen or heard what the other part was doing. Which seems like, what a disaster. Like, how could this possibly work? But what I find so exciting about it is the fact that that risk-taking, that willingness to say, this may not work, that willingness to fail, is such a great practice. It's something that particularly people who come up through a design curriculum in a school, I speak not just for Cornish, which is my direct experience, but also when I was in school and was in doing music, it's we're so unwilling to show unfinished work. That anything I put on stage in front of people has to be perfect. I have to know it's going to work. I have to know this sonata inside and out if I'm going to sit down at the keys. I have to have all of my cues perfectly leveled and perfectly done before the opening night audience, all of this stuff. But being willing to take a risk and put together a combination of works that allows for or accepts the possibility of failure is really, really interesting. And what that then opens up for creators, so people who are going to do, say, an installation, is we're going to set up conditions under which some sort of performance can happen, and then we're going to step back and let it kind of do its thing. We're going to let the audience, or we're going to let the actual performers who may not have rehearsed it directly, kind of riff and let the piece be generative. So Cage did this in 1966 in an event called Nine Evenings Theater and Engineering. It took place in New York City, and it was a co-production, if you will, between Robert Rauschenberg and Billy Kluver, who was an engineer at Bell Laboratories. And it partnered engineers from Bell Labs with avant-garde artists, be they musicians, dancers, visual artists, and what have you, and they all came together and collaborated on new experimental work. There's not really anything that had happened like this at this scale. They did it at the, I think, the 78th Street Armory. I'm sure I'm getting that wrong. But it was basically, it would be like if we took over the entirety of the Center House building at Seattle Center, gutted everything, and turned it into a massive stage where new work happened. It was on that sort of scale. Also with the sound of all of that bare concrete, and we can imagine what those reverb factors were like. So Cage did a piece where he very, very specifically gave up control. He put in elements that released him as the composer from any sort of active control over its input. So he had open phone lines to various phone boxes or apartments in Manhattan that were just open, that were all calling into a switch that were going into his PA. So he had no control over what comes into it. In one of the performances, someone did walk up to a phone booth on the street and go, hello? Hello? And that's became part of the performance. And likewise, this photo here shows these lights that were triggered by photocells that were at about ankle height in the whole performance area. So as people moved within to the sine wave generators and to the various filtering systems that they had, as they passed these triggers, it moved lights and it produced sound. And it was something that could not be blocked or could not be cued. It had to just happen in the moment. So each night that they performed this, the performance was, by definition, different because they might call a different apartment. Someone may decide that, like, man, you know, sine wave at 250 is really my friend tonight. I am just going to hang out at this box and I'm not going to move around too much. The lights would go in a different way. The tones that were driven by the switches would move in a different way as well. So the last thing I'll talk about really quick before we take a break and then look at some examples is a piece that I was really fortunate to be able to help out with, that it was the last performance at Tsuyama Space, which is in Belltown on 2nd Avenue, or was. Unfortunately, the building was sold and the Siama architecture firm that hosted this incredible space for new work and performance for many, many years, has had to relocate. This was the last piece that was put on here. It was called Generativity. It was by Fernanda D'Agostino out of Portland and Isabelle Chenier from Montreal. And it mostly took the form of a video and audio installation piece, three-channel video, that cycled through a number of media that Nanda constructed. And the audio component was a lot of, I would say, environmental ambience, but the way in which it functioned... First of all, did anyone happen to see this? Has anyone been to Siama Space? Yeah. You can't see them in the photo, but throughout the room were Kinect sensors that were running multiple patches within Max that was controlling the luminosity and the motion of the video and also the level and actual source file playback of all the audio. So this was proximity sensing reactive installation. So this particular area that looks like kind of a pool on the ground that was downfiring projection of water and of a person in water who would occasionally swim up sort of at you. And the closer people got as they sort of walked around it, there was a Kinect sensor capturing them here, running a patch in open framework that was then spitting into Max that was saying, you are now within the bounds of my vision, and you're there for longer, and you're there for longer, and it's altering the audio levels. And as I was helping set this up, the thing that was the most exciting was when people sort of got it, and they realized that if they went closer and then they went out, that the sound was changing, that they were actively changing and creating that part of the installation. So I have a couple examples to show from this as well. But to wrap up really quickly, because I know we have to take a break, first of all, thank you very much for indulging me tonight. And when we think about our practice as theater designers, if that's our if that's a path we want to go down, as musicians, as creators, as generative artists, as visual artists, what I will encourage you to do above all else is please, please, please be willing to fail. It is incredibly powerful to learn from things that don't work. I encourage everyone in their practice always, not just students, but, and I constantly remind myself of this, that not everything you do is going to work, and that's okay. That's how we get better at what we do. And I used to really have to try and get this across to my students, like, a lot. But it's an important practice. It's a good personal practice. And when we come back, I have some examples of the stuff that we talked about to look at, things that, by all means, please come up and play. And we can talk more specifically about the equipment that's here, how it's used theatrically, how it's used in installation. And there we go. So I know that I spoke very fast and can teach an entire semester on this, and I have. So this was very compressed. I apologize if anything was very quick. But by all means, please... I'm happy to take any questions outside of here, email, what have you. So thank you very much.
I'm going to take 10 minutes, and we will pull that screen up a little bit. We have cookies.